Gezond en wel, over leven in balans.
Dit is Argus Oog Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Desiree Rover with Healthy and Well on Argus Oog Radio in the Netherlands. And today is April 1st, 2012. And maybe for many people it's a day of practical jokes, but the guest that I have on right now is not at all a practical joke. She has written prolifically about the ruling elite, the subject of tonight, and I've known her for ages by the website News with Views, where she has written many articles, and she has her own website, and I won't keep you in suspense. My guest of tonight is Diana Spingola.
Welcome. Hi, how are you?
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah, Diana, you are a very prolific writer, and I'm very curious how you got to this subject, because as a medical research journalist myself, I entered into the arena of the world elite who is ruling everything by way of the medical arena. And what you have been doing is you have been a quilt designer, and that is beautiful. I've seen your work. You use beautiful colors. And isn't the quilting a something that is being done by the Mennonites?
Yes, but they do more practical pieces. The work that I did was more artistic, where people would use them not for their beds, but they would put them up on their walls. They were more art pieces. And I actually only did probably two or three bed-sized quilts. But most of them are, you know, just for the wall.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I know a friend of mine here in Holland. She's an American girl, and she is the treasurer, so to speak, of the Mennonite quilts that came our way here in Holland after World War II, in a way of helping the Dutch people rebuild their homes after the war.
How wonderful.
Yeah, and she has organized many exhibitions with these quilts, and they're sort of traveling around the world with her sometimes. And it's, yeah, it's amazing. That's why I know there is such a history in quilting. Otherwise I wouldn't have known.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So that is the quilting part, your artistic side, your creative side. And, you have been traveling, teaching and lecturing on your methods of quilting also?
Yes, I did that for several years. In fact, I worked in the textile industry as a sales rep, and I represented five or six different companies as an independent rep working on commission, and I traveled in five states. And I needed something to do, you know, in the evening after calling on the customers and whatnot, and I didn't want to just sit in my hotel room and watch TV, so I would take my sewing machine with me, and I also taught quilting classes. I also did heirloom sewing, which is using old laces and fine batiste cottons, and I've always kind of been a teacher, always teaching, you know, sewing of some sort. And so that's how I kind of developed the quilting thing. And I thought, gosh, I ought to write a book. So I decided to create some patterns. And the watercolor quilting, the original method, you would take 2-inch squares and it was very tedious. You'd piece them all together to create a mosaic-like kind of a piece, kind of a Monet watercolor piece. And I thought, you know, there must be an easier way of doing this because, so I developed a strip pieced method and wrote a book with 30 quilt patterns in it. And then I followed up with another book with 30 patterns. And then I also did, created some Bargello quilt patterns, which are still on my website, spingola.com. And then after making about 100 quilts, I just kind of burned out.
I understand what you're saying. I have been making glass bead jewelry for ages when I was younger. And, all of a sudden you just have done it all, something
sure.
Like
that. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And before that, I used to make porcelain dolls. And then I just got tired of that too. So I think when you think you've perfected something, then why continue? If you've filled the objective, and you feel like you've perfected a technique or something, then you just feel like, okay, let's move on to something else.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I made a lot of clothing for my children and for myself and my husband. And there came a time that I thought, well, I know I can make a raincoat, but how can I make it very special? And then you go into details and you go into more details to make it something that you have fun with yourself still.
Sure.
That, yeah. Okay. Well, but these days you are quilting together, as I may use the metaphor of speech, the figure of speech. You're quilting together all sorts of bits and pieces from world history. And just now your second book is finished about the ruling elite. And the first one is called A Study in Imperialism, Genocide and Emancipation. And now you have the Zionist seizure of world power.
Right. That's, and it should be out in about a month or less.
Yeah, well, keep me posted. I will tell all my listeners when it's available on Amazon and on your website maybe also.
Alrighty.
Yeah, well, those titles are very clear about what they are about. I think for the title of the second book, The Zionist Seizure of World Power, that is what I see all around me. But what is the exact definition of the word Zionism or Zionist? Your definition, let me rephrase.
Okay. I have used the word Zionist or Zionism up to about 1930. And then when I do my third book in the trilogy, then I'm going to change the course, because Zionism is the tactic that they used, that the Jews used, to kind of seize power and to get support behind them, to get a government to support them. And it seemed like a religious kind of a thing, and a religious objective. But in fact, it was really an economic objective. And so they combined it, and they used religion and prophecy to implement this takeover of the world for world domination. And I've tried to make it not copying other people, but actually showing how they did it, in the Ottoman Empire, the tactics they used, the fact that the people that now call themselves Jews have absolutely no genetic connection to Palestine. And I start the book off that way, explaining what Zionism is and how it was first used, who these people are, and it's pretty interesting, I think, because these people really, when you look at their background, when you understand what kind of people they are, and then you can look around you and see what is happening in today's world, because these, well, you know, the term was first used actually in Revelation 2:9. And I quote, "I know thy works in tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them that say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan," unquote. And so you kind of get the idea that these people do some very devious and deceptive things in order to gain power, and that they are going to kind of take over some of the blessings that were not meant for them, but were meant for another people that they have absolutely no connection to. And we start out in the book with the first chapter is the non-Semitic Khazars. And many of the Eastern European Jews are not Semitic and have no genetic connection to Palestine or to Israel or to Abraham. And there are a lot of revisionist studies that indicate this. For instance, the 13th tribe by Arthur Koestler, the Ashkenazic Jews, a Slavic Turkic people in search of a Jewish identity by Paul Wexler, the Jews of Khazaria by Kevin A. Brook, and more recently, the invention of the Jewish people by Shlomo Sand. And, you know, these, the people that wrote these books are Jews. And, they are actually describing where this people came from. They're not, and this isn't about anti-Semitism, which is basically an accusatory political weapon utilized to silence unwanted queries and opposition to detrimental Zionist policies. Now, truth can withstand the most intense scrutiny and does not fear investigation, but rather it invites exploration. So people use the term anti-Semite to silence dissent against U.S. government policies as they relate to Israel. And when we look at what is going on in the Middle East, we can see, you know, the monopolization of the media here in this country. And, you know, in Europe, I know that if Europeans criticized Israeli policies, people remind them of the Holocaust. And if people oppose Israeli policies towards the Palestinians, then people accuse them of being anti-Semitic. And so it's kind of a catch-22. You really can't talk about this comfortably without being targeted for as an anti-Semite. The Khazars have been classified by anthropologists as Turco-Finns, and they're not descendants of Judah, one of the 12 sons of Israel, but were warlike, violent people who originated in Asia, where other nations drove them out. And they worshipped the phallic symbol and engaged in sexual excess until their king, King Bulan, B-U-L-A-N, because of their moral degeneracy, abolished idolatry and compelled them to adopt one of the three monotheistic religions, either Islam, Christianity, or Talmudism, which we know as Judaism. And they chose the latter as the new state religion. And the king then imported rabbis from Babylon, who opened synagogues and instructed about 4,000 feudal nobles. And the converted Khazars remained in Khazaria, and their descendants also embraced Judaism, and it's a theocratic religion where leaders functioned as civil administrators. So that is basically the origination of the people that we now think of as Jews.
Yeah, something happened, so I missed your story about the Khazars and the 13th tribe that I picked up. But I know the subject matter that the people who call themselves Jews these days are not. And what I see is that Jewry of today is a very modest percentage of the world population. But when you look at positions that they are taking in governments, in banking, in psychiatry, then their numbers are overwhelming.
Oh, absolutely. And that is true in every nation. They basically are a state within a state They remain unassimilated, very select. They congregate together, and you can find them in the media, in academia, in banking, in just about every, well, in the medical industry, as you have found. I'm sure you have found it that way.
Yep.
And yet, basically, they are, you know, like 2% of the population or less.
Yes, but they are everywhere in the top realms of industry and all the areas that you mentioned.
Right.
So that is, to say the least, peculiar.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I have a quote here from Eustace Mullins's book, The Curse of Canaan. And there is someone who says, with the present work, Eustace Mullins hopes to end a 3,000-year blackout behind which the enemies of humanity have operated with impunity in carrying out their satanic program. It is very late in the history of our civilization. This book is written solely with the goal of renewing our ancient culture and of bringing it to new heights. And Eustace Mullins himself says in the book, after 40 years of patient study of the crisis which faced humanity, I arrived at a very simple conclusion. All conspiracies are satanic.
Oh, I certainly agree with that. And, you know, it's very interesting. We also talk about people who help them. It's not just the Jews. The Jews would not be able to excel as they do without the people that they support and without the people that support them. And one of those peoples are the Christians, the Christian Zionists, and certain governments. And the first government leader that promised to support them and help them was Napoleon Bonaparte. And he was a Freemason. And while he was camped near Acre, that's in Palestine, and it's spelled A-C-R-E, he announced in a written proclamation to the Jews dated April 20th, 1799, that he was going to restore Palestine to them. He ascended the throne as the Emperor of France in 1804. And on October 6, 1806, the Assembly of Notables, a group of people who consulted with the French emperor on state matters, issued a proclamation to Europe's Jewish communities inviting them to send delegates to the Sanhedrin. And this was scheduled for October 20th of 1806 in Paris. However, the meeting did not take place until February 9th, 1807, where 100 rabbis and 25 lay people from various parts of Europe met to authorize, in behalf of world Jewry, any compact made with Napoleon and presumably other government leaders who would support them. Now, despite the diaspora, the Sanhedrin exercises authority over Jews worldwide. The Jewish Sanhedrin functions today with judges, financiers, intellectuals, orators, and politicians who hold meetings where they devise essential requirements for the welfare of Israel. And so we do have the Sanhedrin is operating now, today, and although Napoleon, because he lost the war, had to rescind that promise. There were other people who picked it up, one of which was Joseph Fry, who was an Orthodox Polish Jew. He was a student of Johann Janik of the Berlin Missionary Society and had converted to Christianity by receiving baptism in New Brandenburg on May 8, 1798. Fry moved to England in 1801. Rothschild, Nathan Rothschild, also moved to London where he became a Freemason on October 4th, 1802. Now, you'll find that Freemasonry and Judaism go hand in hand. They're both very international. They work together, and of course, in the late, it was 1784, I believe, or 87, where the Illuminati decided that because the Freemasons were already in existence, because they were already had this brotherhood, which was very international, that they would infiltrate Freemasonry. And so you find that a lot of Jews adopted Freemasonry. Even Lenin was a Freemason. So anyway, by August 17, 1808, Rothschild had become the financial advisor to the British government, and the Rothschilds frequently fund organizations, even Christian groups, and then maintain their typical anonymity behind a non-Jew founder. So in 1809, Fry organized what is called the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews, which he later shortened to the Jews Society. Now, probably, I'm quite certain that Rothschild funds advocated the concept of Jewish settlement in Palestine as early as 1809. And so then you have this group of people in Great Britain. In Britain, I refuse to use the word great. Now, so even before the Battle of Waterloo on June 18, 1815, several individuals in Britain had already adopted Napoleon's idea of restoring Palestine to the Jews. Now, Napoleon lost the war, as I mentioned, and had to rescind that promise to restore the Jews to Palestine. Now, keep in mind, there could be actually no restoration because these Jews are Khazars. And so they have adopted this name, Jews, and so they are going to exploit the scriptures, exploit Christianity, exploit prophecy in order to seize land that is in a very strategic place in the world where it could govern because of its strategic location. Now, there were other conversionist type of organizations, including the National School Society, which was a charity school of the established church, the Episcopal Jews Chapel, and the school at Palestine Place in Bethnal Green. There was another individual, Lewis Way, W-A-Y, who was a prominent exponent of 19th century restoring the Jews to Palestine, and behind Christian Zionism. And he gave about £20,000 to the Jews Society and got them out of debt. So you find a lot of Jewish people funding the Jews Society, and the whole function of the Jews Society was to convert Jews and to also do this restoration. There was a banker, a British banker by the name of Henry Drummond Jr. He was a member of Parliament. He was very friendly with Mayor A. Rothschild and was very connected that way. And between 1821 and 1823, Drummond sent Bavarian-born Joseph Wolf, the son of a rabbi and a Christian convert, to Jerusalem. That was just about the same time in 1822 that the Rothschilds unveiled the Star of David, which is a hexagram symbol of Zionism, which is now the flag of the Israeli state as their family emblem. And so you see all these happening very early. And we usually think of Christian Zionism as something that is relatively recent. But in fact, it had its beginnings in Great Britain. Now, in 1830, Drummond founded the Apostolic Church and nurtured the Jews Society, which probably had little to do with converting Jews to Christ, but rather it was a vehicle for the implementation of a counterfeit millennium. Jews detest the idea of Christian conversion, but Zionism, rather than Jewish evangelism, was the society's priority, and that is what they did. And then, you know, we often wonder, well, how, you know, what kinds of events, drew attention to what people like to think of as, Jewish persecution and that kind of thing. Well, on February 5th, 1840, Father Thomas, a French citizen and the superior of the Franciscan convent in Damascus, and his servant disappeared. The French consul there began an investigation in the Jewish quarter during which officials extorted confessions through torture, allegedly. People refer to this event as the Damascus Affair. Now, Lionel Rothschild, Moses Montefiore's nephew convinced the British government that it should respond to the Damascus affair in order to assist the persecuted Jews and the missionaries of the Jews Society in Muslim countries. Now, this was 1840, pretty early. Montefiore and the Rothschilds initiated a campaign to defend Jews in Syria, wherein Jews from around the world participated to aid their brethren. Eventually, wealthy Jews utilized this tragic event to unite the Jews and target attention on the minority population, the Jewish population, in Palestine, Russia, Romania, and other places. Apparently, for the first time in history, wealthy Jews, the Rothschilds, and the Montefiores could lend support. And, of course, this was, a gathering money kind of an event. Let's gather a bunch of money. Let's be humanitarian. Let's collect a bunch of money and help these people in Palestine. And it sounds like a pretty good idea, except you have to understand that a lot of the money that is collected for humanitarian purposes never actually help those that need it the most. They usually end up in somebody's pocket. And anyway, on August 11th, 1840, Lord Palmerston wrote to the British ambassador at Constantinople regarding the Jews. And he wrote, and I quote, "There exists at the present time among the Jews dispersed over Europe a strong notion that the time is approaching when their nation is to return to Palestine. It would be of manifest importance to the Sultan to encourage the Jews to return and to settle in Palestine because the wealth which they would bring with them would increase the resources of the Sultan's dominions. I have to instruct your Excellency strongly to recommend to the Turkish government, hold out every encouragement to the Jews of Europe to return to Palestine." Unquote. Now, this was before the Crimean War in 1854. And quite frankly, the Sultan rejected the request. And because they really didn't need any money, they really didn't want Jewish settlement. And what's the point? And so 14 years later, you have this horrific war, and the Turkish government is in need of funds. Now, there were funds that were available internally, but somehow they were forced to go to the international bankers in Great Britain to get funds, and the funds came with a great deal of interest. And through their lack of wisdom and lack of wise spending, they did not use the funds as they should have. Certainly, after the war, they had this debt, and they had used some of these funds for riotous living and not building infrastructure. The other thing that happened in 1840, and so they were in debt. And any country that is in a great deal of debt is very, very vulnerable to the bankers who place them in that debt. Now, also in August of 1840, a newspaper published a report saying that the British government was considering a restoration of the Jews to Palestine. Apparently, Lord Shaftesbury, who had religious motivations, persuaded Lord Palmerston to intercede along with newspaper support. And Shaftesbury, related to two prime ministers, had visions of Britain restoring Israel and redeeming humanity according to his interpretation of ancient biblical prophecy. And so you had these people, the Brits, in bed with the Jews, talking about this very early on, before the Zionist movement ever began.
And isn't that always the tactics of these people, that they let somebody else create or bring into reality the ideas of their agenda?
Oh, absolutely.
They never do themselves. They never do anything themselves.
No. If they can get somebody else to do the dirty work, and lay the groundwork, the foundation, and then they get, they reap all of the benefits, and that's very good for them. And, certainly the Damascus affair, it was terrible, but it was not necessarily an isolated incident against minorities. But the Damascus affair laid the indispensable foundation for the creation of a Jewish state. And to my way of thinking, as I, you know, I usually look at wars as, false flag events. And I believe that it was probably a false flag. It was an event, that was probably staged by agents, in order to allow Britain to go in there and create a presence there, to create a consul there. And, England was, you know, it's a historically imperialistic country. And, it, you know, it had an interest, a religious interest in the Holy Land. They also saw the economic, political, and colonial opportunities as early as 1840.
Yeah, and when, because apparently in the Talmud, the number of 6 million Jews is mentioned the first time, but have you seen where in this part of history the number of 6 million Jews, dead Jews that is first mentioned?
I have not just, I have not found that up until about 1904. And when they started, the U.S. press started in about 1904 talking about the terrible things, the alleged terrible things that the Russian government was doing to the Jews in the Pale of Settlement. Now, Russia awarded the Jews a huge, huge piece of land just for their settlement. And Jews early on, the Khazars early on, went into what is now Poland, into what is now Russia. And so there was a very, very large, population of Jews. And, you know, they attempted, the Russians attempted to isolate them, where they would do the least amount of damage. Because they were, as I said, they were warlike. They were irreligious. They worshiped the phallic symbol. Wherever they go, the culture is denigrated. I believe we've seen this in the United States with all the garbage out of Hollywood, the TV movies, the television programs. My goodness, I think, excuse me, if you were to go back and watch some of the early TV shows, when TV first became popular, like in the 1950s, you would find a different type of program. It was like night and day. And now when you turn on TV, I mean, you see the most atrocious, amoral scenes that one can imagine in prime time. And this has been a slow degeneration from the 1950s to, you know, up to this point where it, you know, little by little, it's like kind of like the boiling frog. You know, you put a frog in cold water and, you know, you just turn up the heat gradually. And instead of, you know, throwing a frog into boiling water, you frog would jump right out. So it's a gradual degeneration of the culture till you have what we have now in the United States and what they also had in the Weimar Republic after World War I.
Yeah, well,
but it was in World War I that they really promoted the 6 million number.
Yeah. Well, I just returned from a stay of 2.5 months in Australia, and the lady I was staying with, she had only Australian broadcasting service, company or whatever they call it, ABC One. And that was television like we had in the 1950s.
Oh.
Amazing. The highlights of that television station in 2008 was very... subtle an old-fashioned British detectives with Miss Marple and such.
Right.
But it was nice to look at because
Yeah, you didn't have to worry about the language or the, you know, sexual content or any of that other stuff.
The violence in Dutch television is so violent all the time, and it's really crazy. I mean, the storyline is about really nothing, and it's only about violence and sex and idiocies. Yeah. It's
right.
Really, and yeah, that has been said already in the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and in Silent Weapons for a Quiet War. It's like they're following their own recipe.
Sure.
In that sense.
And it certainly desensitizes the people who are watching it, so they will feel compelled, along with the video games that were developed by the Pentagon in conjunction with certain corporations in the military-industrial complex. The people who are watching this stuff, the people who are playing these video games, will then feel okay about going over to Palestine or to Iraq or to Afghanistan or to anywhere else and kill the people that the U.S. government has targeted.
Yeah, well, and the ultimate experience in that is the drones that are being like a video game that are being created from America somewhere. From USA, somewhere, a soldier sits with a joystick and he can steer and control that drone that is bombing Pakistan or Iraq or Iran or whatever.
Sure.
And that's amazing. And I heard someone in the military say that these young guys who have been playing with these video games all the time, they are very good at playing war in reality. But there's only one problem with these pilots. They have no off switch. So
exactly.
They never stop doing what they're doing. And in that sense, they have been roboticized, you could say.
Right. They have no conscience. And of course, when you are, whether you're in an airplane or whether you're using remote control or whatever, when you don't look into the eyes of the person that you are aiming to kill, then there's just, you don't feel it. You don't smell the blood. You don't see the death. It's just dropping bombs and, without, ever thinking about the thousands of people that you are slaughtering, the homes that you are destroying, the children and everything else that you are destroying, you're just, it's more mechanical. And the young people now have been trained via these video games developed by the Pentagon. These people have been trained to have a trigger finger and no conscience.
Yeah.
They're desensitized.
Yeah, it's frightening. It's very frightening.
And we often think, well, who is doing this behind the scenes? You know, you mentioned the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, and that's a very important thing, too. And you also said, well, you know, there's such a small percentage of the population, and yet they have such power. How do they get this phenomenal power? It is because they are united. And we are living in multicultural societies, for the most part. We have become a multicultural society here in America, and that is happening throughout Europe. And the only people that they don't want to assimilate are the Jews want everybody else to assimilate and homogenize, but they want to remain select and chosen, which is their word. But they are very, very united. And they began this quite a long time ago, on October 13, 1843, in Sinsheimer's Cafe in New York City. 12 German Jewish Freemasons representing the 12 tribes of Israel founded B'nai B'rith International. And it is an order exclusively for Jews and half-Jews. And they intended to introduce a program of cultural, philanthropic, and mutual aid activities and to halt ethnic criticism. By 1855, they had 20 lodges in different parts of the United States. And so they have programs. And one of the programs is, that early, was to halt, to completely stop any kind of ethnic criticism. Now, another organization that they had was called the Alliance Israelite Universelle. And, you know, an aggressive minority population needs a well-managed worldwide organization to facilitate their internationalist agenda and manipulate circumstances behind the scenes. Now, Adolf Cremieux, spelled C-R-E-M-I-E-U-X, and he was born Isaac Moishe, M-O-I-S-E, was a Jewish lawyer and diplomat, and James Rothschild funded funded Cremieux and the organization called the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which Cremieux founded on May 17, 1860 in Paris. Now, this organization endorsed a program of enlightenment, emancipation, and promoted the worldwide protection of Jews from anti-Semitism. It's a worldwide organization. They formulated an official pact for widespread public distribution. The founders integrated the ideas from the Revolution of 1789 through 1799, which were equality, justice, human rights, together with principles of Judaism. Now, of course, when they're talking about human rights and equality, they're not talking about equality and human rights for all of us. They are talking about these things for themselves. And Cremieux said, and I quote, "If you believe that a large number of our fellow Jews, still overwhelmed by centuries of oppression, poverty, distress, humiliation, and cruel edicts, can recover their human and civil dignity, if you believe that the ways of the corrupt should be proven and corrected and not merely discussed, in opening the eyes of the blind and not forsaking them, relieving those who are beaten and supporting them, and not being satisfied with expressing condolences, defending those who are slandered and not remaining silent, Jews of the world, come, listen to our call, join us, lend us your support and assistance," unquote. Now, the Jews, since about 200 A.D., have been kicked out of about 108 countries. And I'm talking, you know, you can include the Khazars, but the original Jews. I mean, when Jesus was talking about the synagogue of Satan, he was talking about the same Jews that hung him on the cross, drove nails into his hands and feet, because he was against usury. He was talking about those Jews who also were dispersed in 70 A.D. Many of them had already gone to Babylon in 587 B.C. as part of the Babylonian captivity. And many of them stayed there and embraced the Babylonian Talmud. And so he was talking about these Jews who did to him what they did, but also the Jews that we know of as Khazars or the Eastern European Jews. So in 1862, the Alliance Israelite Universelle created a network of schools in order to disseminate a multicultural, humanistic education to over a million children. The organization in its schools promotes the significance of maintaining a special bond among Jews. Now, there are some people who will say, oh, but there are some good Jews and there are Zionists and we need to separate them. We can't clump them all together because they are not all bad. But when it gets right down to it, the Jews have been raised to maintain this special bond. They are educated. They don't go to the same schools that we attend. They do not have the same experience. They do not have the same culture that we do. And currently, there are about 50 such institutes and branch schools attended by tens of thousands of students who learn about their Jewish heritage and loyalty to the Jewish tradition. Now, initially, the Masonic Alliance Israelite Universal functioned as a powerful organization for the extension of Jewish power over Gentile nations by whatever means possible. And it used the B'nai B'rith as its executive organ. They largely developed an institutional network in the bigger urban communities, and whether you're talking about in this country, in America, or whether you're talking about countries in Europe, it is the same. They have organizations, and the organization's motto, the Alliance Israelite Universal, the motto was and is, all Israelites are comrades, quote unquote, period.
Yep.
We're one.
Yeah, and they are really having an in for all of us. But also what I see is what Dr. Rebecca Carty sometimes says, evil is also evil to its own. Some of these Jews will not hesitate to put the lives of other Jews on the line to get where they want to be.
Of course. I believe that they are probably the people who started the pogroms in Russia. I believe that they have probably started, well, we know they did Kristallnacht in 1938 in Germany. We know that they have done a lot of the false flag kinds of things. They have persecuted their own in order to implement their cultural and political agenda. We even have individual Jews in this country who have accused others, say at their schools, their college, of writing epitaphs on their door, and they've set up cameras and discovered that it was the person themselves, the accuser, that was writing these things on the door.
Oh yeah, to get something going.
Oh yes, yeah. And in Skokie, in Illinois, there was a big, supposedly a big neo-Nazi parade in Skokie a generation or more ago, and come to find out it was organized by the Jews. And Skokie is a very Jewish community, and they organized this neo-Nazi campaign and parade in order to target Germany, in order to make the neo-Nazis look bad, in order to play the victim card, saying, oh, those poor Jews in Skokie, look what they have to contend with. Look what the neo-Nazis are doing. Isn't this terrible? And that is what they do.
Yeah.
Because victimhood, you can collect money. You can collect a lot of money. And that is what they recognized early on when they were collecting money in 1840 to send to these poor people in Syria and Palestine. They learned that when people have empathy and compassion for somebody that is allegedly or sincerely in trouble, that people are generous. And so they found out, wow, this is good. We got to use this in the future.
Yeah, that's a good recipe. Well, I find that victimhood of Jewish people, I find that rather offensive, I must say. I mean, my father has been a prisoner in the Japanese prison camps in the war in Indonesia, and that's why he got cancer, and, he died when I was very young. So, in a way, I'm also a victim of the war. But I never think that way, because I don't want to be a victim.
Of course not.
And the victimhood of Jewish people, I really think it's childish also, apart from being manipulative.
Oh, of course. Yes. It's very interesting, though, my older brother was in Vietnam, and he died just recently of cancer. He was there, he did three tours of duty. And he was a medic, and I'm sure that Agent Orange certainly contributed to his cancer death.
Yeah, and Agent Orange is from a Jewish company, Monsanto, otherwise known as Mount Satan, as I call it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so, and even the people there, that 3 million Vietnamese citizens died. And they continue to suffer from birth defects from Agent Orange.
Yeah.
From Monsanto. So, this group, the Alliance Israelite Universelle, said, and I quote from their manifesto, "The union which we shall create will not be French, English, Irish, or German, but a Jewish world union. Under no circumstances shall a Jew befriend a Christian or a Muslim, not before the movement comes when Judaism, the only true religion, shines over the entire world," unquote.
Oh, gosh. I'm not looking forward to that.
Well, it's already happened in this country. We no longer have a manger scene at the White House on Christmas, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. But we certainly do have a giant, giant, giant menorah.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, and I saw the rabbis lighting the menorah and their hats flew off because of the wind.
Yes.
What sort of sign is that?
Yes. And when you think of our laws, the legislation, some of which, 2,700 pages. I mean, if that's not right out of the Talmud, I don't know what it is. Because the Talmud, absolutely details how every Jew will live in every aspect of their lives. And that is why, the Jews were so, attracted to Marxism. Because Marx, he just merely streamlined Talmudism for Gentile consumption. And Marx was a Hess protege, and Hess, what was Hess's first name? He was very early, Moses. Moses Hess. He was a Jewish philosopher, and he basically was Hess's protege. And Karl Marx was a Freemason. Again, we have that coupling of Freemasonry and Judaism. And, that Marx, in his Marxism, streamlined the Talmud so that the Jews would accept Marxism. And in fact, it was Marx, or Hess, that introduced Marx to Friedrich Engels, and this began a very lengthy collaboration. But nationalism is something that the Jews embrace, and Marx wrote, "Whoever denies Jewish nationalism is not only an apostate, a renegade in the religious sense, but also a traitor to his people and to his family," unquote. And so, you see why and how, actually that was Hess that wrote that, you see why and how it is so easy for the Jews to maintain their continuity, because they do embrace the same kinds of mentality, and they have a sense of obligation and loyalty to other Jews, no matter what. And so when we say, yes, the tailor down in the corner, yes, he's not going to, promote warfare, but he's also not going to deny other Jews. I mean, you can see videos and whatnot on the internet where you have, in fact, just recently, there was a young Jew saying, oh, this is terrible what the Jews are doing, and I'm totally against what they're doing in Palestine. I'm totally against, you know, several other things. But he won't say anything about the Holocaust. He won't say anything about pedophilia. He won't say anything about the Talmud. Won't say anything about a lot of other things, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like the fellow that wrote...
Perception. Yeah.
You know, they'll expose a few things, but they won't expose the expose the sacred cows.
No.
You know, just a few things. And it's unfortunate that they don't, you know, if you're going to come out and be a whistleblower, if you're going to come out and deny what your people believe and call, you know, tell it like it is, do the whole thing. You know, don't just give us bits and pieces and think that there are some of them that aren't like the rest of them. So.
Yeah, they have different ways of doing things. I'm also thinking about the Kol Nidre, the vows that they renew with their God, every year, which supersede, the vows that they, the promises that they make with other people.
Right.
So.
And this year, that day that they're going to be doing that is, it falls on September 25th. And basically it just says, well, you can, you know, vow to do anything you want, whether it's serving in Congress or functioning in Congress, I should say, or whatever. Your vows are meaningless. So when a Jew takes a vow, even if you, become president of the United States and swear to abide by the Constitution, you can do the Kol Nidre and forget all about that.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we've had those presidents, right?
We have one now.
Yeah, also.
Yes.
Yeah, what I find amazing is that so many people fail to observe that politicians say one thing and do another. And basically, what they all do is ushering further the same agenda that had been there before they were put into place in elections and that sort of thing. So how is it that people cannot see what is happening right in front of their eyes?
I think it's because people are so indoctrinated to trust. They trust the politician. We are a very submissive, docile, population here in this country. We have been trained that we are to accept authoritarian figures, you know, teachers and politicians. And even though you have a large percentage of the population that say and admit that politicians are a corrupt bunch of people, they still go to the ballot box and vote for them, and they still think that if they elect just the right man, gosh, if we just elect Ron Paul, or if we just elect this guy, or if we just do this, then things are going to be all right. But that is just not the case, because whether you're talking about the left or the right, you are talking about Jewish control. The Marxist Jews support and control the left, and the Zionist Jews support and control the right. And, back in the 1890s, Levi Baruch stressed that the Jews should retain Judaism so that other Jews would not view them as traitors, getting back to that commonality that they all have. And according to Baruch, Jews should control the world, merge the races, abolish borders, eliminate the royal families, and establish the Zionist state. And Hess, Moses Hess, an early advocate of socialism, helped found Zionism. He lived in Paris when the revolution began in 1848. And, these are things that were established back during the European revolutions in 1848. And then you have the Marxist revolution here in this country that most people refer to as the Civil War. And when students go to school, and they learned that it was the Civil War, and doggone it, it was all about emancipating the slaves, and it was about maintaining the Union. No, it was not. It was a Marxist revolution, and it imposed Marxism, it imposed militarism, and I covered a lot of this in my first book. So you have these revolutions within a short period of time. And in fact, many of the people that fought in the revolutions in 1848 in Europe came over here and fought on the Union side in the revolution that went on here in this country to totally alter our country here.
Yeah, and the world over, through all through history, soldiers fight in wars where they never had the full information of what they're really doing. So they are often, or most of the time, cannon fodder for the man behind the curtain, so to speak.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And yeah, all wars are like that. Every single solitary war is like that. And, you know, it's a false flag, and people, you know, keep in mind that the media is controlled. So they use television to program people.
Yeah.
And it's a continual thing. And whenever you have a false flag event, you have to have control of the media in order to maintain that cover story. Like with 9/11. If they didn't own the media, if they didn't control the media, then real journalists, real broadcasters would have come forth and said, hey, wait a minute. You know, the Muslims didn't do 9/11. Look at all this information we have. But here, 10 years after the fact, not only do they control the media, but I think that they also control the skeptics. In other words, I believe that there were people in position before 9/11 that were going to control the so-called truth movement, so that they would lead the truth movement, lead the people who were skeptical, who say, oh, I don't believe that is what happened. I don't believe what I saw on TV. I believe that was fake. And so those people are going to look for common thinking people. They're going to look for a group of people that think like that. And so they will join together, and they'll go to conferences, and they'll say, well, that was an inside job, and doggone it, we're going to come to the bottom of this. And here we are, you know, 11 years later, the truth movement hasn't moved any further ahead than it had, you know, 10 days after it happened. Because
yeah,
it was controlled. It was a controlled truth movement.
Yes, and I see that here happening in Holland as well in smaller groups, because there is, I don't know where I found it, I have to really dig deep to find it again, but there is a document that states that when two or more people come together to have a truth movement, a movement or of some sort, then in no time someone will join who is basically a mole or a sleeper. Bring havoc into the little group.
Right.
We just lived through that here in Holland, and it was amazing what happened.
Yes. Right after, the end of 2006, I created a list. I used to belong to Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And then it broke up, as it was meant to break up. There were two of the leaders had a falling out, and so it broke apart, as it was meant to do. And I had a Yahoo list, an email list, and I sent an email to members of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth and invited them to join the Yahoo list, and I had a lot of people. And then all of a sudden I began to see that there were a lot of people on the list who were just troublemakers, just absolutely troublemakers. And finally the list just fell apart. It just fell apart. And so they do have people, well, they have people who listen to alternative radio, who call into the program to cause division, and to introduce false ideas.
Yeah, I see that happen at Republic Broadcasting programs sometimes, and with Oracle Broadcasting things that I listen to. Yeah, it happens sometimes.
Sure.
It can be quite amusing as well.
Yes, it can be kind of funny. And even the things that are meant to be funny have a way of discrediting the person who is the object of that funniness.
Yep.
You know, even though it's, you know, it seems like fun and games, it plants a little tiny doubt in a person's mind.
Yep.
And I see people working together. There was a program on one of the networks where there was a gentleman on that is obviously a intelligence agent, and somebody called into the program, and they basically bashed one of the women who is a revisionist historian, and I thought, my goodness, was that not the slyest way? You know, they pretended to be opponents here. The guest and the caller pretended that they were on opposite sides. But in fact, the caller introduced the idea that this woman, was not who she said she was, which allowed the guest on the program to say, oh yes, she belongs to the ADL, and she, you know,
oh, yeah.
So they basically really just discredited her as much as they could, when in fact she's a stalwart. But that's how they do it.
Yeah. Well, it's I see that with Dr. Vera Scheibner, whom I was staying with in Australia, and people do it with me as well. I call it character bashing. They resort to character assassination or character bashing instead of reacting on what you are saying or what you have been written.
Yes.
And what you have been writing. So, and that tells me that what I have been writing or what Vera Scheibner has been writing is correct, because otherwise they would shoot that out of the water. But no, they go bash the person.
Right.
Yeah. So,
you know, it's very interesting in talking about the Zionist. The Germans absolutely renounced the idea of introducing the Jewish people into the international community as a state, because this project, this whole Zionist project about creating a state in the center of the Ottoman Empire, was something that they felt would absolutely ruin Turkey. And so Kaiser Wilhelm withdrew whatever support that he ever had for the Zionist movement. And he did that in about 1898, somewhere in there. And so you can see that just at that point in time, that Germany would become a target. For that reason, and for economic reasons also, because Britain was definitely against Germany and felt that they were a competitor.
Yeah, okay. That is certainly true. I have found that as well. But I think this is a good moment to have a little pause, so we can pour some tea and do some other things and mend our throats. Your
okay.
And we're going to listen to, let me see, David Chambert, Exploration. Ah, that's a beautiful title again, Hans. Thank you.
Dit is Argus Oog Radio.
Een andere tijd om leven.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Second half of Healthy and Well of April 1st, 2012. This is Desiree Rover, your host, and my guest is Dejan Spingola. And we are talking about Dejan's second book in a series of three. Oh, gosh. That's a lot of work, Dejan.
I know.
In a series of three that she's writing about the ruling elite. And the second book that is about to appear is called The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. And yeah, you don't mince words in what's what. And basically you take us through the history of things, and that is what I found. I created a timeline of Western medicine to also see the patterns that come out of those pages. Is that how you started to do things, or was it different with how you worked?
Well, I wrote the first book, and I didn't even think to do a timeline there on that book. And in the second book, I thought, well, I think I'm going to do a timeline and include it in the book, maybe at the right at the beginning of the book, so people could use it kind of as a roadmap, and so that they could connect things that happened in one area of the world with something that was happening in another area. And the timeline grew so expansive that I thought, oh, I can't add this to the book because it's already going to be long enough. And so I have put it online, and I put a link to the, you know, the, not a link, but I guess you could call it a link to the timeline in my book. But if people go to spingola.com, that's S-P-I-N-G-O-L-A, spingola.com, then they can just click on the image of my second book and bring up a timeline so that they could see exactly how many things happened in a particular year and how all of those things are so significant. And, well, if you look at 1897, all the things that happened in 1897, and then you move forward and you see, you know, wars in 1898 and, you know, the Boer Wars and the invasion of the Philippines and the, you know, invasion of Cuba and the taking of Hawaii. I mean, if you look at all of those things, you think, holy cow, this is kind of significant. And so it's, I think it's really important to have a timeline. And if I think of it, or if I have the time and make the effort, I'm going to go back and do a timeline for the first book also. Because I do think it's really important, or I might just combine the timeline in the one that I already have. I think it'd be interesting to have just one big timeline.
Yeah, it is, because you see patterns emerging. That is what I noticed. And I picked out a few things out of your timeline. In 1890, Rockefeller purchased the Encyclopedia Britannica. That is how they do it, right?
Yes.
They own education. They own history. They own the media, television, Hollywood. By the way, Hollywood movies are... well, prophetic is not the word, but it's like foreshadowing the real events sometimes.
Oh, yes.
And also prepping us to accept things or to start accepting things, like these movies where these viruses are breaking loose from laboratories or whatever, and then the whole rigmarole that happens after that. That is a beautiful way, again, to... make people afraid for viruses to begin with, and then to prep them to accept vaccines. And I'm very happy to see that the false flag event with the H1N1 in 2009 fell totally flat. I call that the plandemic.
Yeah. It sure did. Yeah.
It did. And they have been working their butt off to get it going, and it didn't want to fly. And I like.
I, I think too many people are recognizing the truth. I think that the internet and all of the people who are actively educating people on the internet really are being effective.
That's where the timelines come in, because pattern recognition, it is about pattern recognition. It is about teaching people to see the pattern, like you create a situation so that the population is going to ask for something that you already have waiting for them, but that the population would not accept without the false flag event.
Right. Yeah, you're talking about the Hegelian dialectic. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I see that time and time again. And when people recognize that pattern, that's enough. They don't need to know all the details. It's the devil is in the details, they say. Yeah, you can be very distracted by all the details. And I mean, yes, of course, people like you and I do too in my area, we go for the details in the history of things. We go into the details into who did what and why and this, that and the other, because someone really has to have it all the ducks in a row. But not everybody needs to do that. Normal people, so-called normal people, when they recognize the pattern, that is enough for them.
Right.
To say, no, we don't want this or that.
Right. And I think that that's why you do what you do. That's why I do what I do, because we have an interest in doing this. I love history. You love what you're doing, and so you're going to try and teach other people to see these things, and it's a wonderful thing. I sometimes I think, oh, you know, why am I putting all this effort out? But I, you know, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, what else would you do with your time, right?
Exactly. Would I sit around watching TV eating bonbons?
Oh, no. But I think it's very important also to look at the logic in things. I started to look at the history of things because some stuff was not logical, especially not in Western medicine. And
right.
So I started looking around and I found that it is not logical. And someone said, Patrick Jordan, a researcher in my field, he said, if in science something is not logical, it is not logical, period. And there is so many things that are not logical in how Western medicine goes about its business towards patients. I mean, it's amazing. I'm amazed that doctors have been brainwashed in such an extent that they want still to do the dance that Big Pharma dictates them.
I think it's because of the authoritarian way that we've all been brought up and also it's the pressure that you're under when you're being taught. When you're in medical school and yeah. What do you do before you go to, when you do an internship and you're working 20 hours a day and
yeah.
You know, you're under a stress situation where it's very easy to indoctrinate you.
I call it boot camp. Medical study of medicine is boot camp. It's a
yes.
Controlled program complete with sleep deprivation. And that has a function to desensitize people.
Sure. And make them stupid.
Yeah.
And then after they get into it, then it's the money.
Yeah, well, there are even universities who select medical students on their wish to make a lot of money being a doctor, not having healthy patients.
Because if you have healthy patients, you're not going to make a lot of money.
Exactly. And Big Pharma is not amused in that case.
No. And we want to keep them amused and making lots of profit, right?
Well, Big Pharma wants to keep itself amused.
Sure.
Like that, yeah.
And you know, if you look back at the early medical schools, the ones that they closed down, you're going to find that Abraham, what was his name? Abraham.
Flexner. Flexner.
Yeah.
That was the way by which Rockefeller, with money from before then the other one foundation,
it was actually the Carnegie Foundation that funded Flexner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that really put an end to everything medical that was not pharmaceutically based. So medicine for black people, for women, everything disappeared except the osteopathy, because they thought, okay, if it's about a better education, better level of education, then we're going to do that. So they did, and in America you can study osteopathy and at 20 universities.
Right, but they don't have the support, they don't have the presence that allopathic medicine has. They don't have the TV support. They don't have the American Medical Association, which, was founded 1847. And, when you look at American TV, there's a lot of commercials that really promote the pharmaceutical industry. And even TV programs, those medical programs.
Yeah, those hospital series and, as I said, a Hollywood movie about a virus, then they imprint again everybody that vaccines work, which they don't, and that sort of thing. So that's how you indoctrinate people in certain ways of thinking.
Right.
And, yeah, I think it's very important that you put history in order, like, mentioning the things that really happened, because the role of Germany, they were not an aggressor, they were a scapegoat of the Zionists, right?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And they were a scapegoat of Britain because, of course, when you're talking about Britain, you're really talking about the Jewish internationalist, because it was the Jews that It is the Jews that basically run the British government. It is the Jews that run the United States government. And so when you're talking about Britain, you're basically talking about the Jews. And because the Rothschilds basically were behind, they're the Jewish money power behind the throne. And initially, the Rothschilds did not support Zionism. And in fact, they refused to fund it. Now, there is a myth going around that they funded the Zionist movement. No, they did not fund the Zionist movement. And so because they didn't fund the Zionist movement, none of the other international bankers in Britain funded or would support it either. It took basically a war, because why would you fund something with the idea that you might not get your money back, although the Jews, the Rothschilds did lend the Turkish government a lot of money, and that is how they happened to get to possession of that country. But it took a war to really break it up, to stabilize the whole thing, and bring about the fall of not only the Turkish Empire, but also the Russian Empire. Totally destabilize Germany, Europe. I mean, World War I, which is what I cover in this book about Zionist seizure of world power, I talk about what led up to World War I and some of the devastating, the false flags, the Freemason connection. Then I also talk about something you brought up just a little bit ago about the 6 million. And it was basically during World War I that the 6 million figure, this magical 6 million figure, came about. And I do want to talk just a bit about the first Zionist Congress, because that That is really important. That happened in 1897. And it's important to consider that when you're talking about what happened really in a very short period of time after that. Theodore Herzl wrote a book. It came out in 1896. And he was attempting to find the necessary money in Paris and London because he had promised the Turkish government that he would help them with their debt because they had all of this debt. We're talking millions of dollars of debt. And so Herzl said, well, you know, let me help you. We'll pay off some of this debt. And if the Sultan would allow the refugees to settle on two continents, the refugees, from the Russian pogroms and everything. And in return, for this, they would also, and this is very interesting, this is very important, when they were negotiating in 1902 about, getting money for the Sultan so that he could settle his debts, the Sultan brought up something really, really significant. He said to Herzl, Theodore Herzl, that if Herzl would help them with their debt by getting some loans and whatnot, then he asked Herzl to form a syndicate for the consolidation of the public debt on terms better than those currently offered by other financiers. Moreover, the government wanted Herzl to develop the entire, and let me quote this, present and future mining resources of the empire under an imperial concession. And Herzl was puzzled. He thought, I don't know, what mines? What mines you're talking about? And the Sultan responded, well, you know, all the mines, the gold, the silver, the coal, the oil, you know, all of our resources. We want you to have some sort of a syndicate. Well, then, all of a sudden, the money was available. The money became available when they figured out that there was more resources in that area than they previously thought. In fact, it was in 1906 that they discovered that the Dead Sea was absolutely full of these very, very valuable minerals. We're talking, in 1947 money, we're talking $5 trillion. And so all of a sudden, you know, there was some international interest in this area because of the resources. And you know, all war is about resources. All wars are economic. It's all about plundering the resources. So that when, for instance, when the United States went into Iraq, when they went into Afghanistan, they didn't go in there to impose democracy, for Pete's sake. They went in there to take over the resources. Yes, and to institute
the museum treasures.
Yes. They either destroy them or confiscate them.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it destroys culture.
Yeah.
Terrible thing.
Absolutely. But I think also that the treasures that he took from the museum there have to do with history of sacred and secret knowledge.
Oh.
Like clay tablets with genetic manipulation experiments on it. That sort of thing.
Ah.
So that's even more interesting, an addition to why they went to war there.
Sure. I keep hearing an echo. I'm echoing.
Oh, I don't know whether I can do something about that. Is it still there?
No, I think it might be my microphone. I just moved it just a little bit. But anyway, you know, with these resources, in 1924, 25, and again in 1928, Louis Brandeis, and a lot of people here in this country also begin to take notice of these resources in Palestine. And this group, they did this group. It was called the Palestine Economic Corporation, PEC. And they started to develop enterprises in Palestine as early as 1924. And so by 1946, PEC funded more than 90 operations and launched or enhanced industries such as chemicals, citrus products, paper, plastics, and tires. And so by 1967, PEC had 11,000 stockholders, mainly in the United States, with millions invested in Israel's industries. And so when we're talking, when the United States is saying, oh, well, we have interest, security interest in Israel. Well, no, it's not really. It's that all, you know, these stockholders, have interest in Israel's industries and don't want to lose any money.
Yeah, right. By the way, I'm never talking about Israel. I always talk about confiscated Palestine.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's occupied land.
Yeah.
They destroyed 500 cities, towns, immediately. The minute they went in there, they destroyed at least 500 towns. And they always say, well, you know, there's this myth that it was unoccupied, that it was a country without a people, and the Jews were a people without a country. Well, why not put them together? And that is a big farce. That was a big propaganda thing. And even Zangwill, Israel Zangwill, wrote this play about it. And it was in the newspapers as early as 1900 or before. In fact, it was Rockefeller also promoted that myth that it was unoccupied. But let me talk just a bit about the first Zionist Congress, which occurred between August 29th and August 31st of 1897. And Theodore Herzl officiated, and there were 200 delegates from 17 countries from around the world. And basically what they did was that they created what they call the Zionist Congress, the program for the Basel program is what they created. And this program, in 1897, this is what they said, and I quote, Zionism seeks to secure for the Jewish people a publicly recognized, legally secured home in Palestine for the Jewish people. For the achievement of its purposes, the Congress envisions the following methods. Number one, the programmatic encouragement of the settlement of Palestine with Jewish agricultural workers, laborers, and those pursuing other trades. See, they wanted to get the more poverty-stricken Jews to go to Palestine first. In order to work the land. Not that it hadn't been developed by the people that were there, but they wanted more development. And so that is why they had these programs in Russia, is to get the people who would leave to leave and go down to Palestine. Number two, the unification and organization of all Jewry into local and wider groups in accordance with the laws of their respective countries. You know, they wanted, like the people in America, to unify behind this Zionist objective in Palestine. Number three, the strengthening of Jewish self-awareness and national consciousness. So while they were passing laws in this country for unlimited immigration from all these different countries, including third world countries, while they were doing that in this country, they were strengthening Jewish self-awareness and nationalism. You know, we're not supposed to think about nationalism here, but we're supposed to embrace internationalism.
Yeah, right.
Number four, preparatory steps to obtain the consent of the various governments necessary for the fulfillment of the aims of Zionism. Now, these were goals that were outlined as part of the Basel program in August of 1897. And they also plan to have some wars. The wars, you know, it's very interesting that a fellow by the name of, Nordau, decided that there was going to be some wars. They knew about when they would break out, and they decided that that they would need the war in order to reach the goal. And they also decided that they were going to use terrorism. Now, terrorism was has always been a part of the Jewish agenda, and this is particularly shown in their assassinations of political people, particularly in Russia. Now, of course, they've done their share of political assassinations elsewhere, especially in this country. When we think of political assassinations that are related to Jews, I think we automatically think of John F. Kennedy, who the Mossad assassinated in 1967 because he would not go along with the Israeli nuclear program. But anyway, in August of 1903, Max Nordau, who was born Sudfeld, he was an atheist, he was a Hungarian doctor and author, and he gave an address to the Sixth Zionist Congress in Basel in August 1903, and he revealed the Basel program for even greater objectives of the coming world wars. And he said, and I quote, "Let me tell you the following words as if I were showing you the rungs of a ladder leading upward and upward. Number one," he talked about the about Herzl and the Zionist Congress, which would happen first. That happened in 1897. Number two, the English-Uganda proposition. The English government said, okay, hey, we're going to give you some land. We're going to give you Uganda. And Herzl said, okay. And he did that with the intention, okay, we will say that we're going to take this and throw everybody off, but we're really targeting Palestine. But we're going to take Uganda just to get our foot in the door. Then, number three, Nordau talked about the future world war. Now, this is in 1903. He was talking about the future world war because the Jews were planning a world war that early. Number four, he said, the next, after the world war, we're going to have a peace conference. And of course, when you have a peace conference, and the peace conference in Paris in 1919 basically had a lot of the Jewish bankers who went to the conference in order to tell the countries, the delegates of the countries that were involved in the conference, and it certainly wasn't Germany and some of the other countries that lost, but the bankers were there to negotiate and the treaties, basically, to negotiate the treaties. Next, number five, they said, and this is 1903, with the help of England, we are going to establish a free Jewish Palestine, which was their goal, number six. They never let, even though they said they'd take Uganda, they wanted Palestine. And they said, and he said, Jerusalem will one day become the capital of world peace, unquote. And so they were planning this, and they were planning that with the help of England, because they already knew that England would be the country that would help them, because Germany had already said, no way, we're not gonna support this Zionist, movement of yours. And so because of their rejection of the Zionist movement, also because of their competition and, their forward, they were very, very industrious. And because of their industry, Britain saw them as a competitor.
Yeah, wasn't it so that there was a period where everything that was made in Germany was forbidden to have that?
Um, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Yeah, it was total, how do you say that? Any Dutch, any German product was not allowed in shops and anywhere.
Oh yes, that was in 1933. Okay. That was later, that was after World War One. Yes. The Jews boycotted, Germany, basically. World Jewry. Now, they couldn't have done this. Entenmeyer did this. Samuel Entenmeyer. Now, they could not have declared war on Germany in 1933 unless the Jews were united in a worldwide entity, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Germany responded. My goodness. Of course they responded. I mean, if we had, well, we do have an entity. Well, the Jews, although they have declared war, a secretive, subtle war on America, but if they came out publicly in America and said, okay, you know, we've been here for a long time, but we are declaring war on you. We're going to, let me follow this along. We're going to shut down production. We're going to insource people. We're going to bring people from India in to take American jobs. We are going to take all of our production to China, so where we can have cheap labor. We Jews are going to destroy America. What if they came out and said that? Instead of just doing it subtly like they've already done. What if they came out and said that? Do you think that if the press ever actually reported what was going on in this country, that the American people would say we've had enough already? If the American people recognized that it was the Jews behind all of this, they would say, okay, we've had enough. We're going to boycott these Jewish businesses. We're not going to buy from this company. We want to shut down the, you know, all these Jewish companies. Yes, we would have responded just exactly in the same way that Germany did.
Yeah. That was good reason, yeah.
Yes. But you see, they're doing it to us more subtly.
Yeah, they do it without telling.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it's really amazing.
So anyway, the Jewish Organization of America was created in 1897. So you had all of these organizations that were promoting Zionism here in this country. I do want to talk a bit about the 6 million number, because I think it's very important that we understand where this came from. And it is kind of amazing that this 6 million number came up in World War One.
Yeah.
And they started talking about it actually before that in 1904, when they were talking about Russia. And it's amazing that the Jews here in this country, in America, really supported the Japanese invasion of Russia. They supported the war, and the bankers refused to lend any money to Russia. Just a small amount. And in 1905. And yet they lent a bunch of money. In fact, they militarized Japan, which I talk about in my second book, how they militarized Japan. They exploited Japan's militarization and got them to go fight a war in Russia. The only reason that they lent them money and sold them military equipment and ships and all this so that they could use them to go against Russia so that they could destroy the Tsar and Russia, which was a Christian, basically. When you look at all of the people that were destroyed in World War One, you're talking about a bunch of Christians. You're talking about the destruction of Christian countries. And yet all we hear with any war is, oh my goodness, you know, those poor Jews, they're in danger. And that certainly is what they talked about here in the newspaper and in this country.
Yeah, it is amazing.
And they do it for profit. That is how they made profit. They created a profitable institution where if you have a bunch of victims, then you're going to have a lot of charitable organizations. You're going to have a lot of reparations when you talk about the destruction during World War I as part of the Versailles Treaty. They pinned all of the cost for the war, including pensions for the people that fought against Germany, pensions for the veterans. Germany was stuck with paying all the cost, and yet they did not start the war. They did not plan the war. The Jews started the war, and yet it was going to be Germany. They were going to destroy Germany so that Germany would never rise again, although she did, and they were going to stick her with all the reparations payments.
Yeah, they did that twice.
Twice. In fact, they resurrected, in 1945, they resurrected, brought back all the reparations from World War I, which is a very interesting thing for them to do. But this groundwork for the Holocaust hoax, as I mentioned, they loaned Japan a whole bunch of money, like $200 million. Jacob H. Schiff loaned Japan $200 million to fund the Russo-Japanese War in an attempt to destroy the Tsarist government. And Jewish leaders like Schiff and Louis Marshall and Isidore Strau aroused national sympathy for the Jews by elaborating on and condemning Russia's supposed barbarity. And Felix M. Warburg noted in his book, and I quote, "As soon as World War I started and it was obvious that a large part of the war would be fought in the zone in which 6 or 7 million Jews lived, particularly Poland, Russia, and Galicia, many worthy people started organizations to collect funds for the sufferers in the war zones." And this, they continued to collect these funds. And according to the New York Times, Rabbi Stephen S. Wise said that he said, in referring to their charity, he said, "Ours is a great charity. We have assembled not to see that the Jew does not get too much, but that every Jew get the right to live. There are 6 million living, bleeding, suffering arguments in favor of Zionism." And this was before the end of the war. "During World War I, wealthy Jews living in America developed a rescue plan for their disadvantaged fellow religionists living elsewhere. On October 19, 1919, Nathan Strau wrote an article for the San Francisco Chronicle in which he claims that 6 million Jews out of the world's 16 million Jews are destitute and starving in Eastern Europe. He claimed that recent reports from American Jewish relief workers indicated that the suffering of the Jews, a third of the entire Jewish race, was so intense that they were standing in bread lines or depending on the soup kitchens of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, the JDC, which was established in 1914 for Jewish war sufferers." See, they planned a war, you know, and then they are going to create these committees to take care of the Jews in the war areas, and to heck with everybody else. Everybody else was suffering too. The Jews weren't suffering over there by themselves. They were actually probably better off than anybody else. And the JDC, the Joint Distribution Committee, is a worldwide Jewish relief organization with headquarters in New York. It is active in over 70 countries, and it managed a lot of operations. Now, Martin H. Glenn, a former governor of New York, wrote an article entitled "The Crucifixion of Jews Must Stop," and this was published on October 19, 1919, in the American Hebrew, and he said, and I quote, "6 million men and women are dying from the lack of necessities of life. 800,000 children cry for bread. and this fate is upon them through no fault of their own, through no transgression of the laws of God or man, but through the awful tyranny of war and a bigoted lust for Jewish blood. In this threatened holocaust of human life, forgotten are the niceties of philosophical distinction, forgotten are the differences of historical interpretation, and the determination to help the helpless, to shelter the homeless, to clothe the naked, and to feed the hungry becomes a religion at whose altar men of every race can worship and women of every creed can kneel, unquote. Well, doggone. I mean, there were millions upon millions of people that were literally slaughtered. And yet, it's the Jews who got the attention in the press. It was the Jews who created the charitable organizations to help their fellow co-religionists. And they kept talking about this. Again, Felix Warburg talked about it again in November of 1919 in the New York Times. Some people call it the Jew York Times. And they spent $30 million, they raised $30 million to feed the Jews in Europe since 1914. And so these people were not tragically, you know, starving. And the Germans were starving because of the blockade. But the Jews managed to get money to their co-religionists in Europe. And they did not suffer throughout, as they claim, throughout Eastern Europe. And who's to say who suffered more? I mean, actually, Warburg said, the Jewish people throughout Eastern Europe, by sheer accident of geography, have suffered more from the war than any other element of the population. Now, why is that? You know, why would a Jewish death or the Jewish population suffer more than anybody else?
They perceive it as such, and they want
yes.
to know.
Yes.
It's amazing how they do that, but it's every time about them.
Yes, it's always about them. Yes. And so we have in this country now the United States Holocaust Museum. Because allegedly ancient prophecies required that 6 million Jews must vanish before the Jews can create the state of Israel. They can return minus 6 million. And Tom Segev, an Israeli historian, declared that the 6 million is an effort to convert the Holocaust story into a state religion. According to the Talmud, 6 million had to disappear in burning ovens. Robert B. Goldman writes, without the Holocaust, there would be no Jewish state. If the Jews could convince the world that 6 million perished in the burning ovens of a Holocaustic war, then it would fulfill the prophecies and they could become a legitimate state. And it is countries like the United States, countries like Britain, who actually institutionalized the Holocaust. And there's a book called The Holocaust Dogma of Judaism, Keystone of the New World Order. And Dr. Robert Brock, who published that book, says, he argues that the taxpayer-funded Holocaust museums in America violate the Constitution as they give preferential treatment and promote one religion above others. They also insinuate that the alleged suffering of one religious and or ethnic group excels and is more historically significant than other groups, such as the millions of black slaves seized in Africa and brought to America by Jewish slave trade promoters before the Civil War. Public government-paid teachers in America teach the Holocaust, again, accorded a special status by the government as historical fact, and no student dare question or dispute its history despite scientific evidence. The dogma makes all willing believers participants in Holocaustianity or Holocaustians. So the U.S. Congress allotted land and millions of dollars of financing to the tax-exempt United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which had its grand opening on April 22, 1993. 30 million visitors have since gone to that museum. The museum has an operating budget of almost $78.7 million, of which the government supplies $47.3 million, while private donations provide $31.4 million. Okay, the government doesn't have any money. What I'm saying is the taxpayers fund $47.3 million to the Holocaust Museum. And that is probably why we have the menorah at the White House, is because the Talmudic religion has taken over the United States. Period. That is the religion. They've influenced our laws. We have Talmudic legislation, pages and pages of things that affect every aspect of our lives, particularly this new Obamacare. If the American Civil Liberties Union, which was also founded by Jews, should actually defy this institution. Because any institution that preaches or promotes the Holocaust in any public place is forbidden by the Constitution. And they should forbid the use of all public funds from supporting what constitutes Talmudic religious dogma. What do you think?
Yeah, again, I repeat the word amazing because that's what it is, how they got it all into place. I know, I have it here. In 2004, there was the U.S. Global Anti-Semitism Review Act under Bush. I have to find it here.
Yes.
That's an interesting one. You weren't supposed to say anything about anything. You could be critical about prime ministers now or ever, and you can't have criticism on Jewish Zionistic communities as promoter of globalism or the New World Order. You cannot say that Israel is a racist state. You cannot say that there is a Zionist conspiracy. And I gave as a comment on that qui s'excuse, s'accuse, who excuses himself, accuses himself.
Yes. Yeah. And yet it's okay to lie and say that the Arabs did 9/11. It's okay to accuse other people of doing whatever they want, but they are beyond, legally. They have protected themselves with their Talmudic laws. In fact, they've even imposed the Noahide laws, which they did in 1991.
Okay, yeah, I keep hearing about the Noahide laws. Noahide laws.
Yes, they imposed those in 1991. The U.S. Congress did
exactly.
that.
And can you explain what these are exactly?
They're anti-Christian laws. Basically, at any time that they decide, they may execute Christians simply for being Christians. I will send you a link to the Noahide laws as they were constituted in 1991. And, it is amazing. They keep talking about how the Arabs are trying to impose Sharia law in this country. Mm-hmm. There is as long as AIPAC runs the government, as long as we have a Congress wherein 300 people sign a pledge to Israel, as long as we have that, there is absolutely no possible chance that they are going to impose Sharia law in this country when the government when Israel already runs our government.
Yeah. I see that the same thing is happening here. In Holland, you cannot say anything about the 6 million figure. You cannot say anything the word Jew is even a word that people can't really say without feeling funny. in our mouth.
Well, it's because we've been so indoctrinated.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And because they're so united.
Yeah. It is really satanic, the energy by which all this has happened in...
Yes. The synagogue of Satan.
Yeah, stealth way, and yeah, awful. And yeah, well, I don't know how we can do something about it, that the last steps in this satanic agenda will not become reality, because yeah, there needs to be a lot of waking up fast.
Well, I think that your program is a vehicle for educating the people, and I think that the more that we educate the people about what has happened in the past, then they will wake up and say, hey, we can't let this happen again. You know, we study history, supposedly, so that we will not repeat those mistakes. They've concealed history. So we have to teach accurate history.
Yeah, exactly. Which history are they studying in school? It's not the right one. It's not the true one. And that's where we come in. Yeah. And then what I see, like with the vaccination religion, when I tell people that every vaccine is toxic, dangerous, and possibly deadly, they have been indoctrinated with this mantra that vaccines are safe and effective, that they look at me as if I am crazy instead of looking at the subject matter and checking for themselves what is what.
But well, they use them as biowarfare.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a weapon of mass destruction. If you vaccinate a baby at the beginning of its life, you have a lifelong patient. If he survives that first vaccine, that is.
Right. Well, you know, the U.S. Army used vaccines in the Philippines, and because they wanted to have mandatory vaccinations over there. And a lot of the, for instance, smallpox was hardly known there. But as soon as they started the smallpox vaccines, then they had huge pandemics, outbreaks.
Yeah, exactly. The same thing with lepra in Hawaii. And yeah, it's a concoction of pathogens and toxins and contaminations that nobody knows what is in it. Because I always say everybody will buy a second-hand car and do a trial run in that car before buying. But nobody reads the product insert of a vaccine before being vaccinated.
Right. And doctors, if it's a doctor that's going to give it, or a nurse at your doctor's office or at some clinic, they don't say, well, would you like to know the deadly effects of this?
No. No, because they are into the religion that vaccines are safe and effective.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, we have our work cut out for us still, don't we? Don't you think, Deanna?
I think we do.
Yeah. Well, and I want to thank you very, very much for your information that you gave. I think you have educated my audience big time tonight. I bet we, and I myself too, have to listen to this show several times to pick up all the bits and pieces that you have given us, because it's very complicated and very intricate. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to your listeners. I really appreciate it very much.
Yes, and I will certainly keep them posted on when your book is available, and I will pick up a copy myself as well, because I want to have this work of yours in my hands, in my study, so I can look things up.
Well, thank you.
The patterns in things again. Yeah. Okay. Well, I have thanked you. I will thank Hans, our technician, for helping us to bring this into the world. And listeners, thank you too for listening. And then we are closing with Manu Korne, Uronin's Peace.
Is Argus Oog Radio.